Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining me tonight, the second seat, the one, the only, the fabulous Blog Talk Radio show host, Silvio Canto, author Silvio Canto of Cubanos in Wisconsin. What's his name? Silvio Canto. Silvio, how's it going?
Oh, absolutely great. I'm still cracking up about that European model. I'm sure we're going to get into that later. But I'm cracking up about that. I thought that was fantastic, you know, but it's a great honor to be with you as always. And I'm looking forward to, 60 minutes of baseball tonight, Rick?
Oh, God, I wish. Well, 58 minutes of baseball, 2 minutes of the Super Bowl.
That's about it. Great
honor.
Well,
we are going
to
talk a little bit about baseball, and I'm curious, what do you think of the Texas Rangers offseason? By the way, for all you non-baseball fans, and you really are missing the good thing, all you non-baseball fans, pitchers and catchers report on February 14th, I think it is, which is just about two weeks away. And so that's from there on, you know, every time they report for work in the spring, in the dead of winter down in Florida or out in Arizona, Jazz, I'll tell you, it feels like springtime to me. I don't know about you. I don't care what the weather is outside.
Right. It reminds me of a time that I was in, when I was living in Wisconsin, I was going to school, and it was like freezing, but they had one of the Milwaukee Brewers preseason games out of Miami, Florida at the time. They used to be down there. And it was so wonderful to be walking freezing to death in Wisconsin with a baseball game on the radio. It was like, wow, there's a future, you know, there's spring down the road. But I saw this thing in Facebook today, Rick, that the Rangers opening day is 73 days away. So we're excited. I'm looking forward to that. I know there's a big game on Sunday, but after that, I follow the NBA and the NHL to a point, more the NHL than the NBA, frankly. But I think that once April comes around, then we kind of focus on our childhood passion there, Rick.
So how did the Rangers do in the offseason? Who were the big additions?
Well, they picked up a couple of pitchers for the bullpen. I thought it was a pretty good offseason, but the biggest acquisition, they picked up Gallardo from Milwaukee for a couple of young players in their system. Gallardo is from this area, by the way. He went to high school here, and I remember him when he was in high school pitching here. And I think that's a really good pickup because they'll have Darvish, Holland, and Gallardo, Cubby Lewis as the fourth. I think they've got a good starting rotation with Gallardo, and they have a couple of guys from injuries that should be back. So I feel very comfortable about the Rangers in the offseason. The two big acquisitions of last year, you know, Prince Fielder and Sin Chin Shu, I always love that name. Those two guys, you know, they gave him a lot of money, but they were hurt most of the year. So if those two guys come back, I think we're fine. I think we're a legitimate contender for the American League West. And so are the White Sox, a legitimate contender for the Central. I like what they did.
Yeah, they improved vastly, I think. Who did they pick up? Melky Cabrera they picked up.
Right.
Kind of a strong power hitting right fielder. It looks like they're giving up on Dion Vicedo, who has tremendous potential, but can't hit the ball. I mean, when he connects, it goes a mile, but he just couldn't hit the ball. They also picked up a very strong left-handed hitter from his pre-agent signing from Washington, Adam LaRoche.
He's good.
They're not done yet.
He's good.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They also picked up a couple of relievers, a closer, the former Yankee closer Robertson, and a good left-hander
out
of the bullpen, Zach Duke. Yeah. So they filled some holes, and I really think they're gonna trade Vicedo and maybe even Alexei Ramirez. That'll be a blockbuster if they trade him. He's a former Silver Slugger, Gold Glover. It's just an outstanding shortstop. But they have some kids who have been waiting in the wings
right.
and in the minors, and who are very talented, very fast. But they just don't have Alexei's skills, in my opinion. But they're probably good enough to fill the bill. And if they get some more arms, they need one more starting pitcher. Right now, they've got Sale. Jeff Samardzija they picked up from from Oakland, who had picked him up midseason from the Cubs. So they've got like three very good pitchers in Sale, Samardzija, and Jose Quintana, John Danks, who's not all the way back from shoulder mm-hmm. surgery last year, who might be better this year. And kind of an also-ran Hector Nowesi, a right-hander who pitched well at times last year. But yeah, they filled some holes, but they've still got some holes. They still need a couple more arms in the bullpen, which is why I think they're going to probably package Alexei Ramirez in some kind of major deal later in the spring.
Yeah, no, they have a very good team. And as we saw last year, it takes about 90 wins to win that division. It's going to take about 95 to win the West. But it's going to take about 90. Yeah. The downside of that, of course, is that the wild card is probably not going to come from the Central. But I like the White Sox. I think they did a good job. And, of course, Kansas City should be favored again, Detroit. So it should be a very competitive race. I'd like to see the White Sox back in it. As I told you, I've always been a big fan of the White Sox because I've always loved those pinstripe uniforms. They're classic.
Yes. Yes, they are.
Classic
except in the late 70s when Bill Beck had to wear shorts. I don't know if you remember
right.
that.
Yes,
Sunday
yes,
games,
I do.
They wear shorts.
I remember when Pat
hated them.
Right, Pat Kelly. Remember Pat Kelly when he was?
Sure.
Remember Pat Kelly, the left fielder. He was the one who one time publicly said that they didn't look like baseball players. But you know that's the way it
that's
was.
One, that's
a lot
what
of teams
were last year. That's what,
yeah,
the way
but a
were.
Lot of players had crazy uniforms in the late 70s. If you remember, the Astros had that horrible-looking uniform, with those stripes. It was absolutely awful. But I'm glad to see that at least common sense has returned to uniforms in baseball.
Yeah. Well, there's a big sporting event occurring this coming Sunday, Silvio. It's not baseball-related, unfortunately.
No. No.
It is the Super Bowl, the most watched American sporting event anyway of the year.
Yes, that's
upwards
right.
Upwards of 80 million people will tune in bars and restaurants and at home and Super Bowl parties. And everybody's going to be getting their boxes for the Super Bowl betting. But it's the commercials. It's the commercials I wanted to talk to you about, Silvio. GoDaddy.
Well, you mean the
GoDaddy
extremely pretty.
GoDaddy actually
the extremely
had,
pretty young woman.
Yeah, that too. But GoDaddy did not have Danica Patrick in their Ooh. Major Super Bowl commercial. They had a puppy named Buddy, and they had this this picture of Buddy running through the fields, running. You know, when it's raining and storming and he's running, jumping fences and he comes and then he starts barking and he comes into this barn and this woman says, Buddy, you came back to us. That's a good thing because I just sold you from my new website online. Well, dog lovers hit the roof. Dog lovers absolutely hit the roof. So now GoDaddy, the CEO, did a blog post on their website saying that they were going to remove the commercial. They pulled the commercial. They're not going to run it. They're going to run another commercial instead.
Well, you know, Rick, the reason the reason that the television commercials, the Super Bowl commercials, were such an important part of the Super Bowl, aside from the fact that they're creative, is that for such a long time the games were so bad that the games were so not bad. That's not the right word. I mean, great athletes, but I'm just saying the games were so lopsided. I mean, I remember when the Cowboys. Yeah, I mean, when the Cowboys were in the Super Bowl in the 90s, you know, they literally scored 40 points every time. I mean, they just beat up Buffalo twice and then the Steelers. So yeah. They were not good games. So I think the commercials kind of took over. But my European model, I'm going to start using that from now on. My European model is predicting that Tom Brady is going to win his fourth ring. I sure hope my European model works because there's another European model that says that the Western European model says Seattle is going to win. So, but I'm hoping, let me just put it to you this way. I don't really have a dog in this fight, as they like to say. I mean, I like both teams. I respect them. They're great teams, great organizations, great quarterbacks. But I like to see Brady get his fourth. You know, he's had five chances to get his fourth. He won the first three. Lost the next two. I just think it would be good for the game to have a quarterback get another ring or his fourth ring. But, I mean, that's just maybe me. Maybe I'm just too romantic when it comes to that. But
you are.
I hope Brady wins.
You are, because the New England Patriots are cheaters. They cheat, cheat, cheat all the time. Anything they can do to get anything they can get away with, they do, as evidenced by Deflategate, which now apparently they are focusing attention
right.
The equipment manager of the Patriots.
Who, right.
For those who don't know, this is how it goes. Each team has 12 balls that they can prepare before the game. Those 12 balls are then taken to the referee, who examines them, makes sure they're the right pressure, so forth and so on, and everything is up to snuff. Then they give the balls back to the teams, and the balls are handled by the home team personnel. The equipment manager is in charge. So,
wow.
I mean, what happened was obvious. The Patriots equipment manager let some of the air out of the balls. And they have not announced anything officially. ESPN reported last week that they had examined all 12 balls, and 11 of them were vastly underinflated. So,
wow.
Yeah. So what that means is, well, if it's underinflated, the ball is easier to grip. It's easier to catch.
Right.
It's easier to handle in the winter weather conditions that were present in New England when they played a week ago last Sunday. So they say the Patriots had an unorthodox advantage. Well, you know, if the game had been close, it might have been a controversial thing.
Right.
But hell, the Patriots won 45-7, for God's sake. It's not
right.
Like,
yeah, I
it's
mean,
not like that would have made the difference, you know.
Not 45-7, and that's probably the reason why the whole thing has not been taken so seriously, because of the score. But one thing, Rick, and you know, I consider myself an above average sports fan in the sense that I really know what's going on. And I remember when my sons were playing little league ball and football and soccer and basketball and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, there were all kinds of rules about equipment and baseballs. For example, each coach was supposed to bring two balls to the game and give them to the umpire, and the balls were provided by the league and all of that. So I was actually quite surprised that the NFL would not have better control of the footballs. I mean, I was always under the impression that it was the referees who had the balls, and they were the ones who would check the inflation. They would check the ball, make sure that everything was fine. I mean, the idea that an equipment manager for either side would actually have the balls, that really caught me by surprise. I just was not expecting that. It would be the same thing as let's say in hockey, if you know, the local team or the home team could control the temperature on one side of the rink or something, so that, you know, one side of the ice would be different than the other. You know, I mean, it's just not
right.
So I always felt that this was something that the league would be on top of. So when I first heard the story, I guess you learn something new every day. I mean, I had no idea that a team would, I mean, that a team would control the football. I had simply no idea of it.
Yeah. We learned way too much about how those balls are examined and inflated and everything else.
Right. Well, inflation has a new meaning. But inflation has a new meaning now, Rick.
Yeah. Sure. Oh, boy. Okay. Let's move on.
Right. All right. Let's do that.
Our guest for this evening, the wild, the wonderful, the wacky, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air Jazz. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, operator. I was holding for the Rick Moran show. Could you transfer me, please?
This is the Rhino Hour of Power. You're about 2 years behind. Did you just walk out of a time machine? You just walked out of a time
machine.
Apparently,
I did. I wasn't aware we were discussing, as my man Mitt Romney would say, sport.
I gotta say, guys, it
was fascinating. There was a long period discussion about, I believe you called it, what was the word, baseball?
Baseball.
So that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that's like cricket, except with the longer, skinnier bats, right?
No, actually, it's more complicated than that. They go around the bases, whereas in cricket, they just go back and forth.
Yeah. Ah, right. Okay.
There you go.
Jazz
yes.
is from, you're going to have to forgive Jazz. He's from upstate New York, where the number one game
Buffalo.
There is a game the Indians used to play. They call that lacrosse, and they play it with sticks, and you bash the fella over the head with the stick and take the ball, and you don't throw it, you don't hit it, you kind of wing it. So
well, Rick,
it's a
wait
great
a minute.
Game.
I think the reason Jazz was mad at me is because being from Buffalo, he still remembers what we did to the Bills one twice, and then when the Stars beat Buffalo in the Stanley Cup. So, Rick, I'm sorry. Jazz, I'm sorry, but that did happen. I couldn't control that.
Well, actually, I'm not from Buffalo. I've never been a fan of the Bills.
Okay,
I am from upstate New York, but it's a big state. People don't live here, don't realize that. But no, I'm a Jets fan, the good team. The really successful team from New York.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
anyway,
they did win a Super Bowl.
Who's your pick for the Super Bowl, Jazz?
Oh, Seattle all the way. I'm expecting another occasion like the last time I remember the Seattle Cheatriot or the New England Cheatriots going to the Super Bowl. You may recall that game when they played the other good New York team, and the Patriots had gone, was it 16-0, something like that? It was like, oh, it was just unprecedented. They were going to finally outdo the Miami Dolphins of the 70s when I was a kid. And then they ran into the Giants, and it was an embarrassment. And I'm looking forward to a similar embarrassment when the cheating Patriots lose yet again.
Okay. Well, actually, didn't the Giants beat the Patriots twice, Jazz?
Yes, they did.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, they beat them twice. The two times the Patriots or Brady lost the Super Bowl, it was to the Giants both times. So
but
you're on a
like
roll
the,
tonight, Jazz.
In New York, you have like the Yankees fans and the Mets fans, and then you have
right.
the Giants fans and the Jets fans. And it's so easy to be a Yankees fan, you know. It's really hard to root for the Mets, and it's so easy to be a Giants fan. I grew up with my dad watching the Jets, and we were around together when the Jets won the Super Bowl with Willie Joe Namath. At that time, he gave me some of the indispensable wisdom that my father loved to dole out. He said, you know what, son, it's very early in the league, but this is a clear sign the Jets are going to be a dominant team throughout your life, so you want to get on board with them. And I've stuck with that.
Right? Yeah.
I've stuck with that all this time. And I may live long enough to see them win another Super Bowl, but it's not going to be soon.
No,
not anytime soon. But that was a great team. Those Namath teams were great. Your dad was right about that.
Oh, yeah.
They were good teams.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's get off Super Bowl. Let's get off baseball. Let's get off lacrosse. Let's talk about Bibi Netanyahu. Ooh. Baby's coming, we think. He may yet cancel. Pressure is building on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. to cancel his upcoming appearance in a joint session of Congress, where he was invited by the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, unbeknownst to our part-time, semi-retired president, and that would be Barack Obama, who has now, you know, he's thrown a tantrum, and he won't meet Netanyahu when he comes here to talk to the Congress about Iran sanctions. And, in fact, he just dispatched his primary political operatives to Israel to help Labor defeat Netanyahu's party, which should be interesting since he's won two elections here in the United States, but we'll have to see how that works out. But Jazz, was Speaker of the House John Boehner within his rights to invite Netanyahu? Was that, or does Obama have a point?
Well, there was a time, Rick, when Obama would have had a point, and I wrote about this week. There are no laws about who can speak to who in terms of things like that. Normally, you would expect that the president would be meeting the prime minister in a situation like that, but Congress, and people seem to forget this, and certainly the president forgets this a lot, is a co-equal branch. And if they want to invite someone to speak and address Congress, then they certainly have that right. There was a time when there would be a certain amount of decorum, and people would say, well, you should ask the president first because it deals with foreign relations, and that's more the executive branch's purview. Well, the executive branch hasn't shown a lot of generosity towards the legislative branch recently. They haven't exactly been following the rules on a number of things. Some people would argue they haven't even been following the Constitution. So, yeah. I don't think Boehner was out of line to make the invitation, and I think if they want to reestablish themselves as a co-equal branch, it's a bit outside their normal purview, but there's no foul involved in inviting him to speak. I'm more interested in what is this backlash against Bibi at home? He was invited by the Speaker of the House to come address Congress. You know, is that some insult to Obama? It's not like Obama hasn't insulted Israel. I mean, they haven't had the coziest of relationships. So, no, I think this is much ado about nothing. I'm not enough in tune with internal Israeli politics to say whether or not that has an effect. He's going to have an election coming up. You know, is he going to get kicked out? Who knows? But to be mad at him for going and accepting an invitation and speaking, that seems pretty petty to me.
Yeah.
Well, it is election season in Israel, and you know, the opposition likes to latch on to issues, and the reason they're saying this is such a mistake is because it's damaging U.S.-Israeli relations. Well, I don't see how much lower they could get.
That's right. That's
you know,
right.
And so the idea that this is that it piles on more damage is kind of absurd. Now, having said that, though, you know, Republicans made a big deal when Nancy Pelosi and a couple of Democrats, I think even John Kerry, who was senator of Massachusetts at the time, paid a visit to that liberal stalwart and reformer, Bashar Assad, President Bashar Assad of Syria, and Republicans went off the deep end, said, "You're undermining Bush's foreign policy." Because we weren't talking to Mr. Assad at the time. This is before he started to gas people. I'm just wondering, Silvio, is there a correlation there? Should the are the Republicans hypocrites for bringing this up now on inviting Mr. Netanyahu to come while they criticize other Democrats?
No, I think Jazz is basically right. I mean, it's a co-equal branch. I think when the Speaker Pelosi and whoever else went with her to Syria, I think she had just become Speaker, I think. So she was on some type of a tour introducing herself. But look, there's always going to be hypocrisy. There's always going to be partisanship in Washington. So that doesn't bother me. What I think what is really happening is that I think when the Prime Minister of Israel stands right next to the President of the United States, in this case, it's such a mismatch that I just think it makes President Obama look very small. And that's what I think is really behind all of this. If the Prime Minister of Israel was somebody else who didn't have the international standing that the current one does, then I don't think it would be much of an issue. But, man, when you see these two guys together, when you see the President and the Prime Minister of Israel together talking, I mean, it is such a mismatch that I think that's what's behind all of this, Rick. That's where I'm coming from with this, Rick.
Yeah.
If I could add one thing to that, Rick, sure. I also think one of the falling down points of that comparison is attempting to make a comparison between Bashar al-Assad and Bibi Netanyahu. In one case, you're talking about should one of the co-equal branches of government speak to one of our staunchest allies. In the other case, you've got some people going and talking to someone who was already well on the way to being a state sponsor of terror, someone who was, you know, at best really dodgy with a horrible record, and talking, you know, like, well, we should go and have some talks between this branch and this guy, even though the current policy of the nation being handled from the White House, as we mentioned before, as it's traditionally done, is looking at that country like some sort of a caged animal. I think that makes a bit of a breaking point. If you're gonna, it's not that they weren't entitled to talk to a foreign leader. I think your choice of which foreign leader, if the foreign leader happens to be somebody who is a state sponsor of terror, I think it adds another dimension to it. So there is room to criticize the choice by Pelosi to do that. If they were going to go and talk to the head of Uganda back in the 80s, you know, right. Like, well, I guess Idi you have Amin, the right.
Right.
Sure, you can chat with Idi Amin, but you know he cut off about 1,000 people's heads. Personally.
Right. No, but right. That's an excellent point that Jazz is. But Jazz is making an excellent. But Rick, I think Jazz is making an excellent point here that these two people are not comparable. One is your number one ally in the region, a person with a tremendous influence because of the Jewish Americans that we have in the United States. I don't think that I understand what you were trying to say, Rick. But I think Jazz has a great point in that this is probably not. Not the most comparable thing there, but anyway, good one, Jazz. I like it.
I was just playing devil's advocate there. Let me continue in that role, Jazz. In that President Obama has a point, you know. If Bibi comes here and advocates more sanctions on Iran, and in fact, the sanctions bill is stalled because Obama cracked the whip and the Democrats all coalesced and said we're not going to vote for it at this time. There are probably 8 to 10 Democrats who would join Republicans in an Iran sanctions bill. Probably not enough right now to override the president's veto, but certainly enough to pass it. Now, the point being that the Obama administration makes a very, very good argument that if you pass that bill, Iran's going to walk out of the nuclear talks. Well, can we now have a standing ovation for that? That'd be a great idea, in my opinion.
Right.
And
right.
Because
exactly.
any deal right now that they are going to sign would be so detrimental to our interests, would not stop Iran if they wanted to build a bomb. That these are exercises in Obama's legacy building. That's what we've got here, and the sooner these talks end, the better.
Well, when you start dragging Iran into it, now we're taking it away from the niceties of, saucers and cups of tea in Congress and talking to an ally in Israel. Now we're getting down to some hardcore meat of international relations when you bring Iran into the situation. I think Bibi Netanyahu has a problem at home because there is a significant break in public opinion, and he has opposition there in his own government, how people, you know, how strenuously they want to deal with Iran. How much saber rattling do you want to do? Do you want to say, we're going to go bomb Iran, or, you know, we're going to watch our own borders and wait and see what's going to happen? And then now you have him coming over making a speech. He's talking to us. There's an argument here between people like how strict should we, you know, Obama would like to be in discussions with Iran, still with this fantasy that they're going to give up their nuclear ambitions. But, you know, okay, granted, I'll respect your opinion. If you think that's a possibility in some fantasy land, then go ahead and negotiate that. But we have other people on the other side of the fence saying they're not to be trusted. They break every deal they've ever made. We have great evidence for this. They're extremely dangerous. They're working on building a bomb. They've made no secret about that. So now we've taken it out of the diplomacy range and into international policy, and I think that's something that both John Boehner and Barack Obama and the prime minister, yeah, they all have to stop and think about that. It's like, well, what message are we going to send? Are we projecting a unified voice? How tough are we going to be on Iran? Because out of all the parties involved, Iran is the bad guy, okay? Obama's not the bad guy. Nancy Pelosi isn't the bad guy, or let's say lady. And how are you going to approach that? I think that adds a lot of spice to the stew, and it does complicate the situation.
Yes, it does.
Well, I will tell you when you Rick, when you realize what great negotiators the Obama administration is, like let's say with Cuba, and the deal they just made with Cuba, when you consider that horrific deal, and now we're supposed to trust these people in negotiating. I mean, you could make a mistake with Cuba, but you cannot make a mistake with Iran because the damage is so much greater. So I just don't trust the administration. I think President Obama is trying to cut a deal. He just wants a deal, period. And that's the worst kind of negotiator. You don't just want to make a deal. You have to get the right deal. And if Iran walks away, hey, I'm okay with that. Let him walk away. Because I don't think they were ever really serious in the first place, Rick.
Well, I've talked about this before. And what the Obama administration did was overturn more than a decade of U.S. policy. We were not going to talk to Iran until, one, they stopped enhancing their uranium, number two, stop being a state sponsor of terror. And I think three, which was kind of iffy, was, have a democratic election once in a while that isn't rigged. So none of those conditions were met. In fact, no conditions were given whatsoever. So what is the only progress, if you want to call it that, that's been made in this deal so far, Jazz, has come at the expense of the West. Iran gets to continue to enrich uranium. They can continue to enrich uranium to 20%, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump from the 80% necessary for bomb-grade material. Would you agree with Silvio's assessment that this is far more so Obama can go down in history rather than actually stopping the Iranians from trying to build a bomb?
Well, I'll start by saying, and maybe we can circle back to this later, I disagree with Silvio about the Cuba situation and that deal, but that's a completely separate subject. I do agree with Silvio about the various aspects of the Iran deal. The deal stinks on ice. We got nothing out of it. They got a lot out of it. You brought up the point about we had these provisions in mind. Well, if you make some significant progress, well, then, yeah, we'll talk to you. And if they did, believe it or not, I would not be opposed to talking to Iran if they actually made significant progress. But one of the problems comes with the aforementioned elections. They do have elections. Well, the elections are total frauds. But even if they weren't, they are electing people to that position who are the equivalent of the White House press secretary. That's just somebody who goes out and mouths words. Okay, the actual people in charge of Iran are not the people who get elected to be the president of Iran. Okay, that person has virtually no power whatsoever. And the real people with the power do not stand for election. And that's just a fact. So, no, there's been no significant change. We've gotten no concessions. So, yeah, I think the president had an idea in mind at one point that he would love to be remembered as the guy who broke the ice, who cut the deal with Iran, who got them to disarm, and made that happen. A laudable goal if you're a narcissist, certainly something to be looking for. But, no, we didn't get squat out of that. I think it was a terrible deal, and it was probably done for personal ambition reasons and nothing more than politics. There's nothing substantive. It's a bad deal for us. It's a bad deal for Israel.
Yeah. One more item on this Iran, on Bibi and Iran, as long as we're talking about Iran. I have read several articles on foreign policy, the website, the magazine website, that claims that Obama's goal here is to make Iran a, quote, stabilizing influence in the Middle East by granting them the role of hegemon. It sounds ridiculous, but it is it's what they've been talking about, the White House and the State Department talking about ever since they began negotiating with Iran. They want to empower Iran so that they can ride herd on the rest of the Middle East and keep the lid on. Is that a good idea, Silvio?
Well, I mean, I don't think it is, because, as I said, I don't see any moderates, if you will, that you can do business with in Iran. And if they exist, they don't have any influence. I just don't trust Iran. I mean, it's as simple as that. And I think that, you know, this is a nation that has been funding terrorism. And I believe they're just buying time. And that's what they're doing. They're buying time. Once they have a nuclear weapon, once they have a WMD, everything changes in the region. And all you have to do is look at North Korea. I mean, North Korea is a country that wouldn't be much of a threat to anybody if it weren't for the fact that it has one of these weapons that they could use and blow up hundreds of thousands of people. So I don't trust Iran. And then when you couple that with the fact that I don't believe President Obama or Secretary Kerry are good negotiators, it just scares me to death. I mean, I just don't see a happy ending when Barack Obama and somebody from Iran are sitting in the room negotiating this deal, Rick.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a situation that should be interesting if Netanyahu carries through and does come to Washington to speak to the joint session of Congress. He is going to call a terrorist a terrorist. He's going to call Islamic terrorism. He's going to, he's going to call it out, and people are going to love him for it because the administration doesn't do that. But we'll have to see. Let's move on, Rick.
Can I just toss in one bone of contention on what Sylvia said? I do think that there is, as with many fables, there's a nugget of truth at the bottom of one of the things that the Obama administration is pushing about this, and that is that Iran is, in my opinion, and you know how I feel about foreign policy, is primarily an isolationist. They are a stabilizing factor in the region. That doesn't mean that they're good people, that they're good to their own people, that they're a good influence on other people, but they are at least stable. And this goes back to something you and I have debated over the years for the last decade, and that is that it's still my opinion to this day, Iraq was a stable force under Saddam Hussein. It was horrible for the Iraqis if you crossed him, and you'd wind up being dipped in acid baths, and your daughters would be dragged off to rape camps and carried off to his,
right.
But you know what? He kept the Sunnis and the Shias apart by being a bigger bastard than both of them put together, and he actually held the place together. And because I'm a selfish person, and I'm an ugly American, that was actually good for us in the long run. It was terrible for the Iraqis. But he was a stabilizing factor. There are certain places in this world where sometimes, and again, I'm a terrible man, I admit it, you need a big, ugly, strong man just to keep a lid on the pot so it doesn't boil over. And for a while, Bashar Assad had kind of that role. And look what that region looks like when you take away the strong man. Then it just breaks down into failed states, and you just got terrorist camps, and now that's what, the entire region is starting to turn into that. I would hate to see Saudi Arabia go down, also a horrible country, with, you know, just their entire theory of governance, the way they treat women, the way they treat, you know, everybody. But you know what? It's stable. So I will give the Obama administration credit, even though they don't mean it that way, and say that it is good to have some stable powers in that region because the whole damn place is melting down.
Yeah.
Well, if I could just say one thing about Iraq,
point.
Though. I understand what Jazz is saying, but the problem with Saddam Hussein is that he kept going into other countries. And that's where he became a destabilizer. Well, he did it with Kuwait. He did it with Iran. He did it with Iran. And I mean,
Iran,
what I'm saying
Iran
is,
kicked his ass, and that was ages
well,
ago. He did do it with Kuwait.
But the Wait a minute, but there was a war, wasn't it, between them?
Yes, there was. But again,
yeah.
Again, I would have no problem with those two fighting each other if it doesn't involve us. Go ahead. Kill as many as you can. But like I said, I'm an ugly American. I didn't want him going into Kuwait, and yeah, he was a bad guy there, but we kicked his butt pretty fast. So that's basically my point, Sylvia, was that he was, at that point, contained. And I'm willing to leave a bad man in charge of a region that's just going to get worse without him, because it wasn't like we could do anything about it, and the place is a mess now. So,
yeah. Okay.
That's all I was saying.
Well, leave it at that.
Okay.
And move on. Thank you. Thank you, Blair.
Sure. All right.
Thank you. We're going to move on to an interesting vote in the Senate that was at one time thought to be a slam dunk. The Keystone XL pipeline it actually got 53 votes, but, of course, that's well short of the 60 needed to break a filibuster, so it failed. There were several Republicans who did not make it to Washington because of the storm, a couple of red state Democrats who would have voted for the pipeline also didn't make it. They still probably would have been two or three votes short, although if it had gotten that close, there's a chance that a couple of other, Angus King, for instance, might have voted for it. At any rate, the point being, Jazz, the pipeline is not that a big issue anymore. I mean, it never was a big job creator. I mean, you know, I read somewhere 5,000 jobs would have been created temporarily while the pipeline was being built. But it was more of a symbol of our commitment to domestic and/or North American oil production, wasn't it?
No, I disagree with that entirely. The immediate direct jobs of people out there swinging hammers and turning wrenches, yeah, that number's not that big. The downstream jobs that go into ongoing support, the jobs that get expanded at the refineries and all of the support services for the oil field companies who support the refineries, those jobs spread out quite a ways. Other existing ones will increase their volume of business. There's more hiring. It's a very robust portion of the economy. So, no, I've heard those talking points from Democrats. I completely disagree with it. We get a lot of papers from, like, AEI, the American Petroleum Institute, other ones that actually list the downstream economic impact of the pipeline. It's significantly more than the Democrats wanted to make it out to be. But why did it fail? Let's remember, this is just the Republicans' fault. This is Mitch McConnell's fault, because we all know that it failed because Harry Reid and the Democrats wanted to put amendments on, and they weren't being allowed to do that. And we all remember how generous Harry Reid was, allowing amendments to be put on every bill that the Republicans wanted to amend. And now these rotten Republicans have come along, and they wouldn't allow them to tack amendments on, saying things like, well, you can do this so long as there's no more carbon emissions, because you all have to say that global warming is killing the polar bears. And they didn't get enough votes for that. So considering how generous Harry Reid was about amendments when he was in charge, you can see how it's entirely our fault.
Yeah. Well, with oil at below $50 a barrel.
Right.
And unfortunately for us, the extraction of oil from sands and shale, it has to be about $70 a barrel for that to be profitable. There is a decrease in the output of oil presently. How long it will stay below $50 a barrel is another question, because the Saudis can't make any money either, even though they're the ones pushing the increased output. But there's no big rush to do this, Jazz. Am I correct in that, or is Canada getting antsy and will look for other means to bring their oil to port?
Canada is not just looking for other means. Canada already has a deal signed that if this doesn't go through, it's going to be one of the – I hope somebody does a documentary on it if it happens. The Chinese are completely are funding a project that they have drawn up and engineered that they are going to go over the Canadian Rockies, dead west, right down. They already have the bay picked out. And if they can drive a pipeline, which will be a engineering project the equivalent of connecting the railroads in the United States east and west in the 1800s, but if they drive that pipeline through and get it going, it will be a monumental engineering feat. And once they get it done, the Keystone Pipeline will be a moot deal because the Chinese will have ships lined up in that bay from here till Tuesday, and they will take the oil, and they will take it over to China, and they will burn it, and they will refine it in a very dirty way compared to how we do it. So, yeah, I think there is a pressing interest in getting it done.
Okay, that's fair enough. How about you, Silvio? Do
I agree. I mean, I think the problem is the $2. Right. No,
it's going down to Houston,
like
right? I mean, the pipeline is going down to Houston.
But I think what Jazz was saying is correct in the sense that, or you, Rick, I don't remember which one said, when you have gasoline at 185, all of a sudden, energy is not that big of a deal anymore. But if it goes back to $4 a gallon, which it could, then I think you'll see the pipeline become a very important issue again. I mean, I like to see it built because I like to see us get as much energy as we can out of North America. But I can see why – I don't know why they couldn't get at least 54 votes today from the Republicans. I thought they would get like 57 or 58 with some Democrats. So I'm a little bit surprised that they fell short at 53. But then they did have a snowstorm, I think, in Washington, didn't they? Or wherever they had
elsewhere.
It.
People had difficulty getting into –
right, exactly.
Which makes you wonder why McConnell held the vote anyway. But
that's a good point. That's a good point. Why wasn't he delayed until the weather was a little nicer, you know?
Yeah. One more thing. Okay. Yeah, let's move on to Cuba because I know Silvio likes to talk about Cuba. He loves to talk about Cuba. And apparently the first meeting between Cuban high diplomatic officials in Cuba and the United States went pretty well. And Fidel Castro, who isn't dead, apparently,
right.
Although there's been a lot of speculation about that.
Right.
He's a zombie.
Says that he thinks that this is a good thing and that it'll probably get done. Silvio, fill us in on the details here. What exactly are they negotiating in Havana at the moment?
Well, they're negotiating right now, for example, issues like immigration. They're negotiating, what happens to Cubans who come after. They're negotiating other issues like trade and all of that. But the biggest problem, of course, is that the Obama administration went into these negotiations without really having done some negotiations beforehand. And for example, I would have sat down with the Cuban government before and said, okay, look, before we go out public and make an announcement that we're going to reestablish relations, why don't we at the very least put together a plan so you're going to show us how you intend to compensate all of those people who had their property stolen? I mean, Americans, not Cubans. Also, why don't you tell us, what are you going to do about these fugitives from American law that you have down in Cuba, including the famous lady who killed a police officer in Philadelphia? And these issues should have been settled before, but these are the kinds of issues that are coming up now. And I think the Cuban government smells that the Obama administration is weak, and they're going to hold out as long as they can. So I just think, again, this is getting back to what we were talking about before about Iran. This is not an administration that knows how to negotiate. You could have negotiated a much better deal with Cuba where a lot of these issues could have been resolved, Rick, before you actually sit down with them and start negotiating where you're going to put the embassy, Rick.
Yeah. Jazz, I know you are a supporter of the opening to Cuba. I am partly a supporter. I'd like to see our conditions that existed for 50 frickin' years met, which include, what do they include, Jazz? What were the conditions before we started to talk to Cuba? Free elections, release of political prisoners, stop sponsoring terror. Well, they may have stopped sponsoring terror. That's open for debate. But the other two, they have not. And yet we're talking.
Well, I don't think they stopped sponsoring terror as opposed to they've really ran out of the muscle and influence to be able to do much sponsoring.
Yeah, okay,
out
yeah.
There. You know, and money and things like that. I think free elections are a joke under a communist regime. There are elections that are held in many countries like that, and they're cosmetic. It's like having elections in Iran, pretty much. So that wasn't going to happen. They did give us a prisoner swap, so to speak. They released some political prisoners who may turn around and be arrested again tomorrow, or maybe they already were. We don't know. So all those conditions, I agree with you, those would be nice things. Those would be great things. We got a couple people back. The rest of the stuff, it wasn't like we were going to get it by sticking with what we were doing. Nothing was going to happen. My whole point about I'm not crediting the administration for saying, wow, you just fixed Cuba. Well, nobody was going to fix Cuba. It wasn't going to get fixed. Nothing was going to change. And anybody who says, you know, if we had just stuck with our policy for just another couple years, it would have been a flowering democracy. No, that wasn't going to happen. I was just willing to try something different, maybe spread a little sunshine, you know, let a little antiseptic of sunshine on society, get a little more money down there, maybe some more people traveling in and out. It would be a very slow progress, very incremental. Could fail entirely. But you know what? What we were doing, it failed entirely. So, no, I don't think it was a brilliant stroke by the administration, but I give them credit. They're at least trying something different. It's not like it's going to get any worse. How much worse could it get?
Well, if I may say something, and that is the embargo was, in fact, working. It was punishing Cuba. It depends what the objective was. If the objective was to overthrow Castro, the embargo was never really intended for that. But the purpose of the embargo was to punish the country for the properties that were stolen and all of that. And I just think that it would have been better to negotiate a better deal, to have settled some of these issues ahead of time, rather than say, hey, we're going to get together, and now we start negotiating. A lot of my criticism is that, Jazz, that they really didn't plan any of this out. I mean, these two groups got together in Cuba, and they were disagreeing on just about everything. I mean, the lady who's in charge of our delegation said, I'm not sure we're going to get this done, because they weren't ready for it. You know, just wanting to have relations.
I agree they didn't plan it out, but whatever the plans were, all the things you mentioned, well, then it just never would have happened. And if your objective is for to make sure it never happens, well, then that would be a great excuse. Sure.
But they had a great opportunity.
None of that
right
was
now.
Going to happen. And the embargo wasn't working because nobody else was helping us. Canadians are down there going on vacation all the time. Europeans are trading with them. We were alone. Nobody else was backing us up. We did
and
not.
And then, why did they want the embargo? But Rick, why would they want? I mean, Jazz, why would they speak so much about ending the embargo? I mean, you're exactly right. The country has other tourists, other companies, other countries are doing business with Cuba. The reason they want the embargo lifted is because they want credit lines. Because the Canadians that you're talking about have had to reschedule their debts. The Mexicans also, the Spaniards also, and they were looking for somebody else to provide them with credit lines. Now, Venezuela has been providing them with energy for the last few years, but that's going to end real quick because Venezuela is falling apart. So I think this would have actually been a good time to push the screws a little bit. And I think something we could have actually gotten Castro to leave Cuba if we had just pushed the screws a little bit, because I guarantee you Raul Castro is not enjoying being the governor of Cuba at this time. It's not a fun country to govern, believe me.
Oh, I believe that, but I disagree that he ever would have left. I disagree that we had enough leverage. We were punishing people in Cuba, but we were punishing the people who weren't in the Communist Party. The people in the Communist Party live pretty nice lives. They oppress their own people. They have little communist reporters in every town and villa reporting on everybody's activities so that they can put them in jail and do all that. But if you're in with the crowd, if you're in with Castro's crowd, you have a pretty good life. You have a great health care plan. You get food, everything.
Right.
Everyone else is starving, and they're being horribly oppressed. But the people who are in charge are doing pretty well, and I think that's a common trait in many communist nations.
By the way, those little groups that you were talking about who keep track of people, they're called the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, and how well my parents know those.
Yes.
Okay, we got about 6 minutes left. I wanted to get to this. The Heritage Foundation put out their Index of Economic Freedom today. And for the first time in 7 years, the United States did not slide backwards. In 2005, we were fifth most free economy in the world. Today, we are 12th, which is what we were last year. And it's interesting, extremely interesting, the nations ahead of us. Some of them surprising. Hong Kong, the first six, Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia, Switzerland, and Canada, are considered free economies. That is, their indices, their criteria reached a certain level. There are 33 countries are mostly free, but ahead of us, in number 7 is Chile, number 8 Estonia, number 9 Ireland, number 10 Mauritius, and I got to switch to here, number 11 Denmark, then us. So one Scandinavian country and one Northern European country, democratic socialist countries, have freer economies than the unfettered, quote-unquote, capitalist society of America. I mentioned 2005 for a reason. It's to show that it's not all Obama's fault, okay? We were becoming unfree, less free, under George Bush, too. So, Jazz, your comments, please, your thoughts on this.
The Heritage Foundation's rating system is accurate for what they're trying to rate, okay? And I can just put this in 10,000-foot terms. Because unbridled capitalism, believe it or not, has some drawbacks. Capitalism does require a little bit of regulation if you want everybody to be free on a wide number of scales. If you look at places like Singapore, if you look at places like Hong Kong, that's unbridled capitalism. If you can stay within the rest of the restrictions, you can make tons of money. There are lots of opportunities, not too many taxes. These are things that Heritage holds near and dear, and I agree with those things. If you want to move into a really free society, if we take the word economic out of the phrase economic freedom, well, then there's a lot of other freedoms you have to consider. And we consider all of those freedoms in the United States. And unfortunately, sad side effect of that is that you come up with a bunch of regulations to make sure that capitalism doesn't run so far into the free-range capitalist area that people are just being crushed by the most successful people. You can like that or dislike it, however you want to feel, but America is more restrictive of its capitalist activities because it's balanced against a whole bunch of other freedoms that most of those countries you listed do not enjoy.
Well, so I'd have to disagree, at least it's on the Harris survey, the Heritage survey. They use as criteria rule of law, which includes property rights and freedom from corruption, limited government, which includes government spending and fiscal freedom, regulatory efficiency, which I think is very subjective and probably shouldn't have been included, but they include business freedom, labor freedom, and monetary freedom. And finally, open markets, trade freedom, investment freedom, and financial freedom. Hong Kong ranks at 90 to 100% on just about all of those indices.
Have you been to Hong Kong?
No, but it's I know it's crowded. And it's, okay. What's it like? I mean,
you can also, it's very much like Singapore in a couple of ways. You can be arrested and thrown in jail for spitting on the sidewalk.
Yes.
You
can be whipped for that, I recall.
You have very little access to a whole bunch of different information. Your ability to speak out if you don't like something the government is doing is extremely limited. So I'm just saying there's a balance between those freedoms and economic freedoms.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Silvio, your thoughts, because we're running out of time.
Well, I was just going to be quick in my answer here, but this index is one that I look at every year, and I value the people at the Heritage Foundation, but I have my own index that I've used over the years. and that is, what embassy has a long line outside? And if you go to any capital in the world, the one place, the one embassy that is busiest with people asking for visas to go to that country is the United States. So there must be something about the United States that attracts people. And maybe we should be higher in that index. I wish we were number one. You know, number 12 is probably not that bad. It's not maybe where we should be. But again, people around the world always want to come here. Anybody you talk to, I mean, I've talked to people from all over, and they're always fascinated by the United States. I don't sense that fascination about Singapore and Hong Kong. I mean, I don't know if there are any people standing outside the Hong Kong embassy in Washington, D.C., looking for a visa to go there to live. So I don't know. That's just my own little index that I always bring into the equation as well, Rick.
That's an excellent point. And with that, we'll have to say good night. I want to thank my guest, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air. Jazz, always a pleasure to have you on. Appreciate you coming on short notice. Had a little trouble getting the guests this evening. But
and now that I'm writing there full-time, just everybody stop by Hot Air, and you'll usually see me blathering and rambling about something inconsequential.
The consummate generalist, which comes from years of blogging, as we all have done. So, Jazz, thanks a lot. We'll have you on again real soon.
Thank you, sir. And Silvio, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Jazz, thank you. As always, have a great evening. I enjoy reading your stuff.
Jazz Shaw of Hot Air, and my co-host for this evening, Silvio Canto, author of Cubanos in Wisconsin. When's the sequel coming out? You know, the Empire Strikes Back. Oh, wait.
Okay, that's another book. I'm not sure. We'll have to figure that out. We'll have to figure that out. Maybe Cubanos play in the major leagues. Maybe that's our next next sequel.
There you go. That'll work.
but thank you so much for inviting me. It's a great honor to be with you. And anytime, I'm a big fan of yours. You had a lot of influence in me blogging, and I've always been a big fan of you and love you people at American Thinker. And thank you so much.
You bet. Silvio Canto was our co-host for this evening. So join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.